More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North. John Rebus is one of the most famous detectives in crime fiction. The creation of Scottish writer Ian Rankin, the hard-drinking, hard-smoking Inspector Rebus has been solving crimes in his own, not quite by the book way, for 25 years. He's also earned Rankin a slew of international literary and academic honors, as well as an OBE from Queen Elizabeth in 2002. 5 years ago, Rankin retired Rebus, but his newest book in the series, Standing in Another Man's Grave, finds Rebus returned to center stage, if not quite in the same capacity as before, and well outside of Edinburgh, his normal patch. Ian Rankin was in Milwaukee last month for a book signing at both Mystery One Bookstore and Boswell Book Company, and he found time to stop at the Lake Effect Studio to chat with us as well. Ian, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
The latest Rebus novel, Standing in Another Man's Grave, it begins at a funeral. And one of the things that I liked about it so much was that it was this book-long contemplation on change and on the inevitability of death. And what do you do when you realize all of that? And how do you negotiate that for yourself? And I know Rebus always is sort of in that outside place. That's where he lives. But he seems to me to be even more unsettled and less at home than ever.
Well, the book is the title is a play on a song title by a friend of mine, Jackie Leaven, singer-songwriter, great Celtic troubadour. And it was a song of his, and I kept mishearing the lyric. The lyric actually goes, "I was standing in another man's rain," which I misheard as grave. And I just thought, what a great title for a book. Jackie passed away during the time when I was starting to think about starting this book and getting the idea for the plot. So I was listening to a lot of his music, and I think there was an elegiac quality. And I was thinking, okay, this guy Rebus is now, he's in his later years, almost washed up as a detective. The police have no room for people like him anymore. Everybody's got to be computer literate and techie and young and college educated. And his way of policing is a throwback to the past. And, you know, the people around him, people like Cafferty, the villain who runs Edinburgh, is a guy whose time is almost past. He's surrounded by younger, hungrier, more venal, less moral villains and possible gangsters. So these are guys that are looking back. They're looking back. They're dinosaurs. And at this, so there is an elegiac quality to it. And at the same time, the initial notion for the story was loss. It was, what would you do if your child disappeared? And as the decades pass, there's no sign of that child. Do you give up the search? Do you mythologize the loss? Do you try and find stories that will explain what might have happened to your child? Do you haunt the stretch of road where your child was last seen? And so forth. And so all this stuff to do with loss and memory and the feeling that the world is rushing past us was all playing on my mind while I wrote the book.
Well, and it's all there. And you talked about the stretch of road, of course. Much of this takes place on the A9 going up to Inverness. And I kept thinking, this is all about traveling somewhere, traveling to somewhere, traveling away from somewhere, trying to find where you're going.
I guess there's a sense in which, in most of my books, if it isn't there, people will find it anyway. There's a metaphor for where is Scotland going. And in this book, Rebus knows Edinburgh very well. He's patrolled Edinburgh now for 17 books. I wanted to get him out of his comfort zone and show him there is another Scotland out there. There are other versions of Scotland, other aspects to Scotland other than what you find in the central belt, the kind of busy part between Glasgow and Edinburgh where half the population lives. There's this road, the A9, which is mostly just a two-lane road, very, very busy road with tourist traffic, and it goes up the spine of Scotland, starts in the central belt halfway between Glasgow and Edinburgh, a place called Stirling, goes up through Perth and Aviemore, which is skiing country, mountains, snow-capped, and goes up past Inverness, which is the capital of the Highlands, and it keeps going until it hits the north coast, and the only thing you can do is jump on a ferry to Orkney. It's an important road, but it's a road that people just usually use as a means of getting from A to B. They're in a hurry to get somewhere else, but it's got an organic life of its own. And for Rebus to use that road, he gets a sense that A, there's another country out there he doesn't know anything about, and B, that there are people who use this road regularly, for whom it is an organic thing. It's a living thing, a living, breathing thing with a life of its own. So, I was trying to get him out of his comfort zone, and maybe me too. Maybe, you know, because I've lived most of my life in and around Edinburgh. And there's this other country out there that's wilderness and strange and has a different way of looking at the world, a different philosophy of life and death.
And yet it's the same country.
It is. I mean, it's amazing to me that a country so small, I mean, geographically quite small, but certainly in terms of population, 5 million people live in the whole of Scotland. That a country that small can be this complex. You know, you go from Edinburgh to Glasgow, which is 40 miles between these two cities. the language changes, the culture changes, the dialect, the words that they use, the sense of humor, the philosophy of life, everything changes. And it does that again if you travel 40 miles north or south. So to try and get a sense of that complexity, I had to get Rebus out of Edinburgh, out of his comfort zone.
I was amused at one point, you take him to Glasgow because he's meeting someone and past Buchanan Street, he's uncomfortable. And as you say, it's 40 miles away from where he lives and has lived most of all of his life.
Right.
And yet it's a city that he...
They're very different cities. Yeah. I mean, Edinburgh is a city that was built in a kind of higgledy-piggledy fashion. The old town was chaotic. It was just, let's put a street here, let's put a street there. If you're a visitor from North America, it makes very little sense to you. You've got to have a route map with you when you go. Glasgow was laid out like an American city. It's all cross streets and it's in a kind of grid pattern. Edinburgh people find that really hard because usually we navigate by there's the castle or there's that building, there's that monument. That's how we navigate. Whereas in Glasgow, you navigate by knowing you turn right or left at this particular street and you come to the next street. So even I get lost in Glasgow. The streets all look the same. I turn right or left and I'm lost. I don't know where I'm going. Rebus is the same. He navigates mostly by bars, I have to say, which is another way you can do it in Edinburgh. There's a bar every 50 yards, so you can navigate by bars. But yes, there's a sense in which he is a lost soul, or else he's just lived a very blinkered life. Yeah, it's nice to stretch him. It's nice to take him into places where he doesn't feel comfortable. And he certainly doesn't feel comfortable going to Glasgow.
No, nor Inverness or...
Nor Inverness.
Why did you bring him back? You had retired him a few years ago. Mm. Was he insistent? Did he have other stories to tell?
Well, I mean, Rebus retired because a cop phoned me up one day and said, Ian, how old is Rebus? And I said, he's what, 58, 59? Why? He said, he's got to retire at 60. I said, what do you mean? He said, the retirement age for cops who are detectives in Scotland is 60. 55 if you're uniform, 60 if you're detective. I thought it was 65, which is the general retirement age for men. So that's why he retired, because in the real world it would have happened to him. I wasn't fed up with him. It wasn't that I had nothing new to say about him. It wasn't that I had ceased to find him a useful means of exploring the world. But I knew what he would do. I knew that he would retire, but he would still work for the police as a civilian working on cold cases. There's a real unit in Edinburgh with the very unfortunate acronym. They're called the Serious Crime Review Unit, SCRU. It's staffed by 3 retired cops, 1 serving cop. So that's what he's doing. So when I then get a plot, a storyline that is a cold case, you know, a child who went missing many years ago and a parent who's desperate for the case to be reopened, cold case as far as the police are concerned, I suddenly thought, well, I've got Rebus working cold cases. I can bring him back. But at the same time, my cop friend, the same one who told me he had to retire because he was 60, phones me up and says, oh, by the way, we're changing the retirement age. And I said to him, well, could a retired cop apply to come back in? And he went, yeah. I said, okay, well, Rebus would do that. If that happened, would he be vetted by internal affairs? Yes. So the cop that I've been writing about since Rebus retired, Malcolm Fox, who's an internal affairs cop, suddenly this isn't just a Rebus novel, it's also a Malcolm Fox novel. Because A, the story demanded a cold case cop, and B, the real world said this could now happen.
Yes, and it's just wonderful that these two guys are together now because it is chalk and cheese.
Oh, completely. I mean, that was the thing. When I invented Malcolm Fox, I've been talking to internal affairs cops and I thought, wow, you'd have to be a really different kind of cop to do this job from the kind of cop I'm used to writing about. You have to obey the rules. You have to work well on a team. You can't be a maverick. You've got amazing powers. You can have a surveillance operation. You can be watching cops every keystroke of a keyboard, a laptop, a computer that they use at home and at work. You're watching them. So you're like, it's Le Carre territory. It's spy territory almost. So I just thought, well, this means that people won't read Malcolm Fox and see Rebus. They won't think they're getting Rebus with a different name. So then when I put the two of them together, it was kind of worrying to me because suddenly I think, well, hey, Rebus is the good guy in this book. Rebus is the guy we're rooting for. We want him back. So Fox has to be the bad guy. He's the antagonist. He's the guy who doesn't want Rebus back because Rebus represents a maverick way of policing, which he thinks should be consigned to the dustbin of history. So Fox is the bad guy, and I suddenly don't like him so much. The first 2 books I wrote about him, he's a good guy. Now he's the bad guy because we're seeing him specifically from the point of view of someone he's investigating. And he's a hard-nosed cop, and he's going about his business, and he's doing it the right way. But because of that, we don't like him. In the future books, I now have to rehabilitate him.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how that relationship evolves. I'm assuming because of the way things ended in the book here that things aren't over yet.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think there's some – having created one character with inbuilt decrepitude because he lives in real time and therefore has to retire, Rebus, I then invent another character who, it turns out, has inbuilt decrepitude because you don't go into internal affairs for your whole professional life. You go in for a period of 3 to 5 years. Which means that any time now, Fox is about to come out of internal affairs and go back into general detective work, where he'll be working in police stations he's been investigating, beside people he's been investigating, and people who don't like him anymore. So the shoe will be very firmly on the other foot. If Rebus comes back into the police, Rebus will want to give Malcolm Fox a good kicking. And because Fox is no longer internal affairs, Rebus can do that.
He can.
Yes.
And that should be very, very interesting.
I think so. I do like to set up oppositions in the books. That's what I enjoy is the tension from oppositions. So Siobhan and Rebus are opposites to a certain extent. She's younger. She's college educated. She's very tech savvy. She knows about the internet. She is a team player.
She's female.
Yeah. And she's female. You've then got Cafferty, who's a villain, but there's an empathy between him and Rebus because they come from the same place, they have a certain moral code, and they see that the world around them is changing. But they you never know if they're going to become best friends or kill each other. Either is possible. So there's an opposition there, a tension. And then with Rebus and Fox, there's a tension as well. And that makes it really interesting because straight away you've got a dynamic, straight away you've got tension, straight away you've got people that are acting like real people. You know, the sorts of ugly things that happen to us in our professional working lives are there on the page.
Well, and also in our personal lives, too, because that is something that I was thinking that the relationship between Siobhan and Rebus this time, there's just this tension,
well,
for the lack of a better word.
You know, I mean, she spent most of her professional life in my books, in his shadow. He's got such a personality and he's such a maverick that she has to be in the shadow. He then retires and she's got a few years to build up her career. She gets promoted. Now she's running cases. This guy, Rebus, comes back into her life and she thinks this can only be bad news. She likes him. She admires certain aspects of his personality. The fact he's tenacious. He won't let go of a case. He's always on the side of the angels, even though he might cross the line from time to time. But he's going to be bad news for her career advancement prospects. So she's really in an awkward place when he comes back into her life and he needs favors because he's not a cop. He's a civilian working for the police. He doesn't carry a badge, so there's certain stuff he can't do. He has to get another cop to do it for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he comes to her almost begging. But of course, he's not going to beg. He's Rebus. So he tries to make it seem as though she's doing herself a favor. But she knows she's going to get into trouble. And Fox tells her that. Fox says, you stay close to this guy, he can only get you into trouble. And that's kind of what happens.
Yeah, it does. And it's going to be interesting to see how that resolves as well. But I also – I just love the the relationship – you mentioned Cafferty. The relationship between Rebus and Cafferty to me just makes me smile because like you say, the same moral code, they probably given – different circumstances, they might have switched places in life at some point. But there's just this humor. I just love it. I love watching them spar with each other.
Yeah. I think that you get a sense, even if you've read none of the previous books, when you meet these two guys, this history there between them and there's always a game being played below the surface. So what's being said in their conversations is one thing, but you know there's something else going on. Cafferty isn't just buying Rebus a drink because he likes him. Rebus isn't just going along to the bar with Cafferty because he likes him. But there's games being played, psychological games. And I find that fascinating. I mean, I think their relationship... Cafferty was invented in book 3 in the series because I needed a little scene of Rebus in a courtroom giving evidence. And that was it. And he was giving evidence against this gangster called Cafferty, who we then didn't see for 2 or 3 books. But he got beneath my skin. And I thought, there's so much I can do with this guy. And it comes back to that Jekyll and Hyde thing. You know, every book I've written is really about a very basic question. Why do we continue to do bad things to each other as human beings? And it's something that a very famous Edinburgh author, Robert Louis Stevenson, explored in his book Jekyll and Hyde. What makes human beings do bad things? Is it chemically induced? Is it society? Is it to do with background? Are we born bad or made bad? And there's something in Edinburgh. On the surface, when you visit Edinburgh, you see this lovely, cultured, civilized city, a very nice place to live. Scratch the surface and there's a lot of stuff happening, a lot of bad stuff happening, and the potential for a lot of bad stuff to happen. So it is a Jekyll and Hyde city. And it's almost there structurally, the new town and the old town. The old town was chaotically built to no rhyme or reason. The new town rationally laid out, planned. So you've got reason and the irrational living side by side. You've got Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde living side by side in the fabric of the city. And someone like Rebus allows me access to every facet of that city, from the corporations and the politicians, the big businesses, the bankers, to the dispossessed, the disenfranchised, the disaffected. Every layer of society is open to you as an author because of that one character, a detective.
Well, Ian Rankin, it has been such a pleasure and an honor having you in the studio. Thanks for stopping by.
Hey, thank you.
Ian Rankin is the author of the John Rebus mystery novels, which includes the latest, Standing in Another Man's Grave. Rankin was in Milwaukee on a book tour last month, and we spoke with him then. There's a lot more of our conversation available as supplemental audio on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect, as well as links to more information about Rankin and some photos from his visit here as well. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air is next.